This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome here today Nadine Strossen, who's a professor of law at the New York Law School and the former longtime president of the American Civil Liberties Union. We're here today to discuss the landmark ruling, might be called that, the major ruling with a lot of interest at the Supreme Court on the so-called Obamacare or Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act's constitutionality. So initial reactions, Ms. Strossen, what do you take away from the court's decision today?
Jim, if I may, please call me Nadine. I, of course, was stunned, as most people were, because the conventional wisdom and prediction was that the Supreme Court would strike down the law as exceeding Congress's commerce power and not uphold it on any other basis. So the conventional wisdom was half right insofar as the Supreme Court did, for only the third time since the New Deal, hold that a federal statute exceeded Congress's commerce power. But what was surprising was Chief Justice Roberts joined the so-called liberal bloc in holding that the statute did come within Congress's taxing and spending power.
Yeah, that was a pretty surprising move. Now, some have speculated. I've seen, for instance, Glenn Reynolds, law professor at Tennessee, who's known in the blogosphere as the Instapundit, suggested maybe this was a Marbury v. Madison move when famously Chief Justice Marshall gave Jefferson the result he wanted, but created the court's power of judicial review and got the legal rule he wanted. Do you think that's what's going on here? What do you think explains this? Because as I read the opinion, both the opinion and the dissent, the tax power question gets pretty sparse treatment, and it didn't get a lot of argument or briefing before the court.
I was very surprised about that fact, Jim, because the taxing and spending power has always been construed even more broadly than the Commerce Clause power. The Supreme Court has never invalidated a statute that has been challenged on this basis as exceeding that congressional power. So the mystery for me was why that was not more heavily emphasized by the Obama administration. And I think the only explanation that I can come up with is that two, actually. Number one, that it was just politically unpopular to call this penalty a tax, and that was a point that had been made repeatedly in the process of lobbying for it and getting it enacted. And secondly, there was a technical question that the court actually considered first, which is this whole litigation barred at this point under something called the Anti-Injunction Act, which applies to taxes? So it does seem a little bit odd to say, well, it's not a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act, therefore we can hear the case. But it is a tax for constitutional law purposes. Lawyers can completely understand that distinction. I say that as a compliment to us lawyers. Namely, the question of whether it is a tax under the statute is purely a matter of statutory construction, whereas whatever label Congress puts on the measure, it is up to the court to decide as a matter of how it functions and how it operates, whether it in fact plays the role of a tax. But the blog post that I just submitted for the Manhattan Institute, I'm sorry, right before we got on the phone, so you obviously haven't had a chance to read it, I called it something like winning the battle, but losing the war for expanded federal power. So for you and your constituents, that would be losing the battle, but winning the war, because the holding on the taxing clause was so extremely narrow. It comes extremely close to saying, as the court did in Bush versus Gore, this holding applies only to this particular statute. I mean, it's written in a way that it has a very, very little of any precedential effect. In contrast, the court cut back on the scope of three power-granting clauses in the Constitution. The Commerce Clause, it construed so narrowly that Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent for the four liberals, called that holding, quote, stunningly retrogressive, quote. Those are strong words, so you should chuckle, because that would be a victory for those who think that, you know, the good old days were really the good old days, when the court, she accuses the court of basically going back to the pre-New Deal era. Secondly, the court gave a very narrow interpretation to the necessary and proper clause. And that was very surprising because in the most recent decisions, with support from Chief Justice Roberts and other conservative members of the court, it has given such a broad interpretation of the necessary and proper clause that Clarence Thomas, who dissented in those earlier decisions, said, you know, this is tantamount to giving Congress plenary police power. Well, clearly they backed away from that very dramatically in today's ruling. And third, on the so-called Medicaid expansion provision, this is a very important victory for states' rights and states' autonomy. Because, Jim, as you know, but let me explain to others, the court has long held that Congress, under its spending and taxing power, can grant money to states and attach conditions on that money, including conditions that would require states to do things that Congress couldn't directly require them to do. The court has acknowledged in theory that if those conditions become so burdensome that they, in effect, coerce the states, that the states don't have a real choice, then the court could strike them down. That said, that has been only hypothetical. The court has upheld every single requirement that Congress has in the past attached to its funding that it gives to the states. To the extent that the lower court said this isn't a real limit anymore, the Supreme Court should repudiate that past dicta in past cases. So again, it was a real surprise that the court, actually with support from two of the liberals, Breyer and Kagan, said, you know, this goes too far. This is not encouraging the states. It's not incentivizing them. Rather, it is coercing them. So that is the first time the court has held that this kind of conditional grant to the state exceeds Congress's taxing and spending power. So three holdings about three major power granting provisions that really cut back in a notable way on Congress's power.
Yeah, I totally agree with you based on my initial reading and instinctive reading of the case, and all of us are just seeing it for the first time today and just wading through it, but it seemed always to me in the 1990s sort of federalism jurisprudence that was developing that the case you talk about, South Dakota v. Dole, which basically said it's not unlimited for Congress to be able to encourage the states or coerce the states through its money, but we don't really know where to draw the line. And I always thought that was sort of a gaping hole if you're saying you can't commandeer the states and force them to do different things, invoking the 10th Amendment, but then on the flip side, you can basically use the spending power to get there. And there's a line now that's been drawn. So I do think that's a very significant holding, which will probably have broader application than the other questions, I would suggest, because the outer bound Commerce Clause question and the very narrow tax question, as you rightly point out, I think are, you know, there's not a lot of cases where that's probably going to come to bear. Am I wrong there?
Exactly. So I think that while the immediate impact is to uphold this particular exercise of federal power, the long range impact may well be a cutback on significant federal power. And from a civil libertarian, you know, or libertarian perspective, I think there's something very positive about this decision, which is that the court also, in construing the minimum coverage requirement, and I'm deliberately calling it that, which is its statutory name, not the so-called individual mandate label, which was applied by opponents. But the Supreme Court, essential to the court's holding, was that it did not see this as a mandate. It said, you know, again, looking at the practical functional consequence to individuals, just as it looked to the practical functional consequence to the states, to the Medicaid expansion, it said, you're not really forced to buy insurance. You are given a choice. Either have insurance, or if you don't, you pay an extra tax. And by the way, as many critics have noted from a policy perspective, you know, the tax that you have to pay is so low that it doesn't function effectively as a meaningful incentive, much less a coercion to actually obtain health insurance. The court gives some statistics about, you know, projecting forward to when the penalty would go into effect, that the monthly average monthly cost for insurance, health insurance, is $400, whereas if you're earning $100,000 a year, your penalty, because the penalty is hooked to what your income is, your penalty would be only $60, or I'm sorry, $200 a month. If you're earning much less than that, it would be something like $60 a month. So it's not coercive. And I think that's really important, not only as a matter of constitutional law, but just the practical implications. I think people were very concerned that the government could force them to buy health care, buy health insurance, could force them to buy and eat broccoli. And the rationale that the court adopted for upholding this really backs away from any notion of government power to compel in that way.
Fascinating stuff. Well, Nadine, it's been my pleasure to have you with us discussing this very major court decision today and giving us your insights and wisdom. Again, this has been Nadine Strossen, the former longtime president of the ACLU and a professor at New York Law School, here with James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute.
Great talking to you, Jim.
Thanks so much.